Hello, and welcome to the podcast of the International Society for Biomedical Research on Alcoholism, or ISBRA, Communications Committee. Today, we will feature two conversations held with the joint winners of this year's Tabakov Award, Dr. Helmut Seitz with the University of Heidelberg, and Dr. Susumu Higuchi with the National Hospital Organization Kurihama Medical and Addiction Center in Yokosuka, Japan. The 2022 ISBRA Tabakov Award will be formally presented at the joint ISBRA/ISBRA conference held from September 17 through 20, 2022 in Krakow, Poland. ISBRA will support the Tabakov Award for Excellence in Research, which includes all aspects of biomedical research on alcoholism, basic and preclinical, translational and clinical work, genetics and epidemiology, with a nice memento. These awardees will also be invited to present a plenary lecture during the joint ISBRA/ISBRA conference this September. Our first conversation today was held with Dr. Helmut Seitz, Distinguished Professor for Internal Medicine, Gastroenterology, and Alcohol Research with the University of Heidelberg in Germany. Hello, Helmut.
Hello, Victor. It's nice seeing you here.
Nice to see you as well. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm hoping that we can spend this time talking about your work, a bit of the journey that you've been on.
That sounds very good. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And of course, I'm very thankful to receive the Tabakov Award. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So Helmut, you've had an extensive career in gastroenterology and alcohol research. I'm wondering how you became interested in that field.
Well, actually, I started to study chemistry. I was very fond of chemistry in school. But after several semesters in chemistry, I realized that obviously there is something much more interesting, that's biochemistry. And in biochemistry, I realized very soon that this molecule alcohol, this very small molecule alcohol with two C atoms and a few others, really disturbs the whole hepatic metabolism. It's really unbelievable how much this little molecule intervenes with everything in the intermediary metabolism. So I had the great privilege to get a very early stipendium from the German Research Society for a 2-year with Dr. Charles Lieber in New York. He was at that time the giant in the field. So I stayed with him more than 2 years, and that was the beginning, actually, the real beginning of alcohol. I was 27 in those years, and of course I took everything what I could take from him and from this laboratory, and also from many other places in the United States, because then I had the great chance to really see these places in the United States. And that was the start, actually, of my alcohol career in 1977.
So this early experience with biochemistry and this fascination with alcohol leading to these sort of early research experiences in the United States with these different labs who are doing that kind of work.
Yes, yes. And we started with a very new thing. It was alcohol and cancer. And then I realized with time that we do basic research, but the basic research is very closely related to clinical research. And the clinical research means to do something for people, for patients who suffer from that kind of disease. So it's a long way from the bench to the bedside. But I think it's very encouraging and to do some research on the basic, but finally it ends up, if you are lucky, at the bedside for the sake of your patient. I think that's another point of the view.
Absolutely. You can study alcohol and you can study the way it impacts the body on animals and mammals and mice and rats. But you know, the goal in some way is one, to further knowledge, and two, to help people.
Yes. And, you know, we started with a very simple molecule at those days. It's called cytochrome P450-2E1. It's a protein which is involved in ethanol metabolism. That was the beginning. And we studied that in cell cultures over the years. We did it in some animal experiments. But at the final end now, 1 year ago, we also could realize that this molecule plays a role in humans. And if you block this molecule, you improve alcoholic liver disease. So to make a long story short, starting with cell cultures 40 years ago, ending up with something which has a real benefit for patients, for people. This is actually what one would like to see. It doesn't work always, but with that CYP2E1 story, I think it's a fortunate situation.
Right. That's incredible. 40 years of work to get from this basic science wet lab cell culture approach to working with humans and finding that impact, that yes. translational piece.
Yes. We did for the first time a study in patients where we give a medication, which we can do in our country because it's suggested for detoxification therapy. And we use that and block the cytochrome P450 and realize that this is of benefit for the liver, that the liver improves under this medication. And so that's the end, actually, of the story. But it opens up new questions, of course. That's always in research. So from that point on, we have to go further and we have to increase that in a great number, in a different number of patients. But I think it opened up a door.
That is fascinating how one project can lead to further projects and further directions to explore in this field.
I agree.
So the next question that I have is, over the course of your career exploring this kind of alcohol research from basic to translational work, what are some of the challenges that you might have faced and how have you worked to overcome them?
Well, I remember that there are other mechanisms with respect to alcohol and cancer. One mechanism is the acetaldehyde story. And it was very difficult to measure acetaldehyde in the 70s, in the 80s. And there were a lot of problems and mistakes to measure it with wrong numbers. So we had to develop a new methodology to measure acetaldehyde, but this only could happen in the collaboration with other people. So I had the great opportunity to work together with a group of Professor Peters in London. With him together, we developed a new system to measure acetaldehyde. And then finally, because of the fact, maybe you heard about that, Asians population in China and Japan, 40% of these people, when they drink a little amount of alcohol, they get flushing syndrome. And if they continue over years and years and years, they develop cancer. So it became clear to us that because of that deficit, because of that mutation in a gene which metabolizes acetaldehyde to acetate, they get cancer. And that was a big idea, a theory. And our Japanese friends finally found that out because they had the opportunity to study these patients. And I think with a worldwide cooperation, without that cooperation, we could never have shown that acetaldehyde, for example, accumulates in the colon or in other tissues. So I think if you have a problem, you have to try to get into contact with other people, to join forces, and to try to solve the problem in a broader range with other people together. I think that's a general idea. And without the help of many other people, I would not have succeeded in many of these problems.
Absolutely. Collaboration in the scientific field is vital. How has the ease of collaboration changed over your career? Has it become easier with the development of these newer technologies? I'm thinking like the internet, like we're able to do a video call currently over Zoom.
You know, a cooperation also depends on people, on person, on the contact, on the chemistry between people. And now remember the last 2-3 years of Corona, we were all separated. We do video conferences, but we never come into a very intensive discussion. You know, the discussions after the meetings, they are probably more important than the meetings. That I always took advantages of that. And of the globalization, of course, starting at 2000 around, it became easier. We had better contacts. Everything became easier. But then with the lockdown, it became more and more difficult. And you can see that in your publication rate. You can see that the last 2-3 years were disastrous with respect to. That's my opinion. And I hope that we open up again and that will improve in the same way as it was before.
I hope so, too. And I think that's the direction that it's going. There are conferences that are in person once again, all over the world, which is great to see, although I hope people are still taking precautions since COVID is still around, though the vaccination is available. It's an interesting point. Like you say, you know, the technology might be there, but there is that human element, still needing people to be interested in making those opportunities to collaborate.
Yes, I think it's very important that you have a fair partner, that there is fairness and that there is that you have trust in the other person. I think this is a very important precondition. Without that, it's not going to work, at least not for a longer period of time. And it also some part of, you know, we're doing research. We discussed that before for various reasons, but also we have fun with research. We enjoy research, and we also enjoy research when we have a partner, when we have some cooperation partner who also enjoys the same thing. So we work on the same line. I think that's very important.
Absolutely. So Helmut, you've talked about a few highlights of your career looking at alcohol and cancer, the new methodology of exploring acetaldehyde and its impact. What would you say has been your main contribution to the field?
I would say there are two factors. One is the long story of cytochrome P450 2E1 involved in carcinogenesis and alcoholic liver disease. As I pointed out before, we finally ended up in a human trial. And the other story is the acetaldehyde story, showing that acetaldehyde is involved in cancer. But the first, among the first who showing that acetaldehyde is responsible for colon cancer in our animal experiments, and also that acetaldehyde accumulates in certain tissue. We were among the first showing that in the colon there are the highest acetaldehyde levels per gram of tissue compared to other tissues in the body. So I think the acetaldehyde story and the CYP3A4 acetylcholine P450 story, these are the two major things, I would say.
Absolutely. And both are fascinating to hear about. You know, some of these studies I've heard about as part of my own education. So it's really neat to get that context of how long those journeys were to get to those points. And what kind of work are you doing currently? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we are still involved in the cytochrome P450 work because now we measure total body cytochrome P450 induction by alcohol by using the chlorhexidine test, which enables you to measure induction, but also you can see, and this is the big question we still have, if people are induced, there are some induced, but not everybody is induced. In other words, if some people have a high CYP2E1 after alcohol, what is the fate of these people for a long distance? Do they have a much higher risk for developing alcoholic liver disease? What is their risk for cancer? So nobody knows that because that's a longitudinal studies. And with that chlorhexidine test, from time to time, we can measure the CYP2E1 and see how it behaves. So I think we're still involved in questions associated with cytochrome P450 2E1 in its role in liver disease and cancer. So I think that would be actually for me the work of the next couple of years if I still be alive. That's the other question.
Of course, of course. You'll work forever and continue to explore this neat protein and how it impacts the body. Well, thank you very much for your time, Helmut. It's been really a joy and a pleasure to talk with you. I do have another question before we wrap up this brief conversation, and that is, do you have a take-home message that you would like to convey to young investigators, folks who are listening to this conversation and thinking that the work you've done is just so interesting and that they would like to be like you someday?
Yes, indeed I have. I have this, what I learned from my mentor, my friend and mentor, Charles Lieber, almost 40 years ago. He always said, think against the mainstream. Try to think against the mainstream. Don't go always with the mainstream. Have the courage to raise theories against the mainstream. They may be wrong, but it's the possibility to break. And then another sentence would be, don't take anything for granted. Nothing is for granted. Nothing is for granted. Be open. And then probably the final thing is, I would say, never give up, please. Never give up. I know research is sometimes very tiresome. Sometimes you have downs, very downs. You are depressed, but never give up. Raise again, go again, try again. I think that's very important.
Thank you very much, Dr. Seitz.
Thank you, Victor.
This next conversation was held with Dr. Susumu Higuchi, Director Emeritus at the National Hospital Organization Kurihama Medical and Addiction Center in Yokosuka, Kanagawa, in Japan. Hello, Susumu.
Hello. Thank you very much for giving, you know, such a great opportunity to explain what I have done so far.
Of course. Thank you so much for taking time out of your morning to join us. And congratulations on being a joint recipient of the Tabakov Award.
Thank you very much. And it was surprising for me that, you know, I was, you know, co-winner of the award.
Absolutely. It is an honor to have you represented with this award. And also, congratulations on your recent retirement.
I retired from my center in March this year. And I thought that before I retired, you know, I thought that, you know, I will have more time, free time to do research and to write papers, but that was not right. Still busy.
Right. Always busy. Always busy. Yeah, yeah. So our conversation today, we do have some questions that I know you prepared in advance. So let's hop right into it. Susumu, I want to ask, how did your interest grow in addiction and alcohol research? How did you come to find yourself in this field?
My career pertaining to alcohol began in clinical practice rather than research. After finishing an internship, I worked in the general hospital as a psychiatrist in the northern part of Japan. I treated several alcoholics staying in the inpatient psychiatric unit of the hospital. My supervisor at that time described alcohol dependence as an incurable disease, as he had never come across an alcoholic who had successfully recovered from the disease. He also said that he was usually asked by the families of alcohol patients to isolate them in a closed inpatient unit for a while as punishment. Unsurprisingly, this treatment was ineffective. Once the patients returned home, they tended to resume drinking heavily. During this period, my supervisor referred me to a domestic self-help group called Danshukai, in Japanese, Japan Sobriety Association, which is an indigenous self-help group like Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States. I was astonished to see lots of recovering and recovered alcoholics at these self-help group meetings. These were respectable members of society. And when they talked about their lives at meetings and how they had been affected by alcohol, it was very different from what I had witnessed at the inpatient treatment unit. This experience convinced me that alcohol dependence was a curable disease and inspired me to focus on the treatment of alcohol dependence. My research career followed these clinical experiences. With regard to addiction, I have been engaged in the treatment and research into behavior addictions, especially gaming disorder, for the past 10 years. In 2008, our center conducted a national survey on drinking behavior and related problems among the adult population. Included in the study questionnaire was a screening tool for internet addiction. The results were surprising. We estimated that nearly 3 million adults were suspected to have internet addiction at the time. This information led us to open the first specialist clinic for internet addiction in Japan at my center. As with alcohol research, methodology for gaming and gambling disorders followed clinical practice.
Learning about the ways that alcohol addiction used to be treated and seeing that firsthand and learning that there is a better way to go about it and using mm-hmm. that knowledge and applying it to other addictions over the course of your career.
Yes, that's right.
Is fascinating and
thank you.
Clever. And thank you so much for your work. Mm-hmm. What are some challenges that you faced in this journey mm-hmm. and how have you overcome them?
My research career started several years later, in 1985, when I moved to the National Alcoholism Center, Kurihama National Hospital, in the city of Yokosuka, Japan, about 75 kilometers south of Tokyo. Although my hospital was a national center, and a clinical research institute had been established in the hospital. Almost no research related to alcohol was conducted at the time. In this context, when I began to conduct research into alcohol dependence, I didn't have a supervisor to call upon, nor funds to support research activities. Fortunately, I found several colleagues who also wanted to do research at my center. We sought to identify external senior researchers with the expertise to instruct us on research methodology for the studies we wished to undertake. One of the latter was Professor Shoji Harada of Tsukuba University in Japan. He taught us how to phenotype aldehyde dehydrogenase type 2, called ALDH2. We used this technique to develop an ethanol patch test, which enabled us to identify with a high degree of accuracy individuals with inactive ALDH2. At this time, I was also interested in undergoing research overseas to develop my research skills and techniques. The director of our center kindly negotiated with the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, NIAAA, in the United States, and secured a position with that organization on my behalf. I was then based in the States for just over 3 years. During the first 2 years, I undertook alcohol epidemiological studies under the supervision of doctors Thomas Harford and Mary Dufour. In my second year, while conducting these studies, I also had the opportunity to take an additional research focus, molecular genetic studies, under the supervision of Dr. Randall Kincaid. These experiences had a great impact on my later research career. After returning from the US to my center in Japan, I and my colleagues began genetic studies of alcohol metabolizing enzymes. The director of my center approved our genetic study research and furnished us with the financial support. At the same time, we found several laboratory technicians capable of providing technical assistance. In addition to genetic studies, we began to conduct epidemiological studies, notably a series of national surveys on drinking behaviors and related problems among both the underage and adult populations. The funds for these studies were provided by the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare of Japan. As mentioned, I was able to utilize research skills I had learned in the United States and from Japanese senior researchers in my later research career. Thank you.
Your work traveling the globe and learning all these different research skills to apply these experiences that you had working with these populations in addiction and being able to study the genetic associations with alcohol metabolism and those enzymes and those national epidemiological studies that you put together, that must have been quite a journey and quite a challenge.
I really appreciate those researchers, who taught me how to do research, both in the United States and in our country. Mm-hmm.
Looking over the course of your career, what do you think has been your main contribution or contributions to this field?
In 1981, Professor Shoji Harada, as I mentioned previously, at Tsukuba University, published a breakthrough paper in The Lancet. He and colleagues showed that the rate of alcoholics with inactive ALDH2 was far lower than that of normal subjects. This was the first paper which clearly showed the impact of genetics on the occurrence of alcohol use disorder. This paper fascinated me, and I thought that I might be able to use scientific technologies to contribute to an elucidation of the etiology of this major psychiatric disorder. The fact that inactive ALDH2 is prevalent among Asians, including Japanese, increased my interest in this research topic. Using a phenotyping method of ALDH2 learned from Professor Harada, we examined the relationship between the ALDH2 phenotype and the skin reaction to ethanol in Japanese subjects. My first paper in English, which was on the predictive property of an ethanol patch test for the ALDH2 phenotype, was published in The Lancet in 1987. Since this publication, the implications of genetic variations of ethanol metabolizing enzymes on risks and features of alcohol use disorder and alcohol-related health harms, including upper digestive tract cancers, have been our main research interest in alcohol research and therefore our main contribution to the field.
What are you working on currently?
As I mentioned previously, I retired from my center in March this year, and my research activities are less active compared to previously. However, I am still involved in the following research areas. As I mentioned earlier, I and my colleagues conducted a series of national surveys on drinking behavior and related problems. We are conducting a similar survey this year to monitor adult drinking behavior and related problems in our country. I have also been involved in other series of national surveys on gambling and gaming behaviors and related problems. I will continue to participate, analyzing data and publishing the findings from these surveys. Secondly, I have played a major role in developing medications for the treatment of alcohol dependence, such as acamprosate and nalmefene in our country. I wish to contribute to the development of other new medications in the near future, if I will have a chance. Thirdly, as mentioned previously, inactive ALDH2 is known to suppress the occurrence of alcohol use disorders because individuals with this genotype experience adverse reactions after alcohol intake due to high acetaldehyde concentration in the blood. Nevertheless, some individuals with inactive ALDH2 can become alcoholics, probably because of other factors facilitating the development of alcohol use disorders. We compared the characteristics of such alcoholics with those carrying active ALDH2 and attempted to identify novel risk factors for the development of alcohol use disorders and to replicate the validity of previously reported factors. Based on this research model, we confirmed that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and some personality traits such as novelty seeking are risk factors for alcohol use disorders. This research is still in progress.
So you've been finding that ADHD and personality traits can be risk factors for AUD.
Yes, these findings have been reported previously, but we confirmed the result. They are accurate. They are correct based on the model we developed.
Clearly, this research has spanned a variety of areas, from epidemiological research to genetic research to personality assessment, looking at these risk factors for AUD. What is a take-home message that you would wish to convey to young investigators, people who are hearing this work that you've done over your career and thinking that that is very interesting and they would like to do it too?
Okay. My final message is quite simple, but before that, I am going to explain the background of my message. Alcohol-related problems are wide-ranging, from health problems such as organ damage, physical injury, and mental health problems, to socio-familial problems such as violence, drink driving, poverty, and family disruption. The magnitude of alcohol-related problems is huge. In 2016, the World Health Organization reported that harmful alcohol use was estimated to result in some 3 million deaths, which was 5.3% of all deaths worldwide per annum. It was also reported that total global alcohol per capita consumption for individuals over 15 years of age rose from 5.7 liters of pure alcohol in 2000 to 6.4 liters in 2016, a situation that has remained unchanged. The magnitude of alcohol-related problems is likely to be worryingly high unless additional and effective preventive measures are taken. The principal objective of alcohol research is to provide basic information that can be used to inform about appropriate measures that can be put in place to combat alcohol-related harm. Your readers, new generation of standard bearers of this mission.
Thank you again for joining us, and congratulations once again to Dr. Seitz and Dr. Higuchi, joint winners of the 2022 Izbra Tabakov Award. If you would like to hear more from Dr. Seitz and Dr. Higuchi, both have been invited to present a plenary lecture of their work during the joint Izbra/Izbra conference this September. Until then, please find the Izbra Communications Committee on the web at www.izbra.com/communications. or on Twitter, LinkedIn, and ResearchGate. Best wishes to you and all your research collaborators.